at the end of the talk, you might regret that you didn't actually have forgetting under your belt before you arrived, in which case you could have actually missed the talk and not subjected yourself to whatever's to follow. Now, first, I guess I'd like to thank Daniel for setting up this this seminar on such short notice, and all of you for coming. My topic today is going to be the power of forgetting. And it's going to be, this talk will be a little bit different from the standard quantum information talk. And so I imagine that since you're, most of you are here from IPC or from Perimeter, even if you don't attend quantum information talks regularly, you've probably been exposed to a couple. And there's a fairly standard, although by no means universal, format for such talks that begins, they begin with somebody telling you what kind of useful tasks they would like to show quantum mechanics can help you perform. Now, an example of such a task might be sending data through a noisy medium to a receiver, a noisy quantum mechanical medium. Despite the fact that the medium is noisy, you want to make sure that your data arrives unmolested. That's a typical example. Another perennial favorite is somebody wanting to exploit the rules of quantum mechanics to establish a secret key between two parties, usually called Alice and Bob, for use in cryptography later. My talk here is going to be a little bit different because instead of starting off with a useful task that you'd like to accomplish and then showing you some clever and hopefully not too fantastical way to accomplish it, I'm going to start off with a useless task, something that seems to be, of no use whatsoever, that is forgetting information. And then we'll see as the talk goes on that this can actually be very useful for dealing with a lot of those useful tasks that people might otherwise start their talks by describing. And so if you're wondering at some point in the talk why it is you're learning about this seemingly useless thing, keep in mind in the back of your mind that by the end, we'll have solved, hopefully, a number of useful problems. And so I'm going to be a little bit like the art critic, imploring you to appreciate the artist's use of negative space, not what they actually put on the canvas, but what they failed to put on the canvas, the information that has been forgotten. Seem to be out of range. Oh, there we go. Now, before getting into my talk proper, I'd just like to go through a historical example of a situation in which forgetting or erasure turned out to be very useful for understanding a problem that was essentially a problem in the relationship between physics and information. And so we're going to rewind all the way to Landauer's principle. The situation here is that we want to use a physical system to store a bit, a zero or a one. Now, for example, if we had a box, and there was a partition in the middle of the box. My computer is operating with a serious delay. So if the particle is in the left-hand side of the box, we'll say that's state zero. If the particle is in the right-hand side of the box, we'll say that that's state one. Now, an erasure process is going to be a process that, regardless of the initial state, is going to revert the state of the box to zero. Now, there are a number of ways that you can accomplish that. One example might just be to remove that partition that's preventing the particle from moving from left to right and introduce a piston. Right? And we can use the piston, if we push it back to the center of the box, then we actually force a one state into a zero state, and obviously the particle is on the left-hand side to begin with, it remains a zero. And so compressing the box in this way actually is one way to erase that information. And in general, if we're going to design a process that can erase information, this is, by definition, a process that has to reduce uncertainty, right? And the second law of thermodynamics requires that if the entropy of the gas is reduced by some amount, in this case, k log 2, then the entropy of the environment has to increase by k log 2. Or equivalently, an amount kt log 2 of heat has to get released from this box into the environment through this process. Now, this, what I just told you, is Landauer's principle, but as stated, it doesn't really do justice to Landauer because it's just a trivial application of the second law of thermodynamics. Now, if we want to appreciate Landauer's insight, we have to keep in mind that Landauer was trying to think about the relationship between information processing and thermodynamics. And he identified erasure as the locus at which this connection takes place. Yeah?
Yeah, so I've always been puzzled by this idea, and maybe I'm missing something, because the thermodynamic entropy refers only to being in equilibrium. But to say that we know that the state is initially in state zero, it's then not in equilibrium.
Right.
Nothing happens, and certainly no heat is released to the environment.
So the point is that if you want to have a process that generically erases, then you have to assume that you don't know the state of the box originally. Because if you're going to know the state of the box, then you should really be modeling yourself as part of the system as well. If the objective is actually to erase that information, if you don't erase it from your own mind, then you haven't actually really succeeded in erasing in this in terms of these definitions. So you have to step outside the system and really model it from a situation in which you don't know the state of the box.
And the claim is that that's equivalent to thermodynamic equilibrium, so assuming that the initial state is thermodynamic equilibrium.
Yeah. Or at least, well, this is sort of a toy version. This is assuming that the initial state of the box is uniformly 0 or 1. If you have less uncertainty about the state of the box, so the state of the box is initially given by a lower entropy, then the amount of entropy that you have to pump to the environment is going to be correspondingly less, at least in principle. All right, so this is where Landauer's insight was really to observe that there is this connection between information processing and thermodynamics, and it occurs at erasure. And the most spectacular application of Landauer's principle has really been to resolve this issue of Maxwell's demon. Now, I'm sure most of you are familiar with Maxwell's demon, but I'll just refresh your memory. So hopefully we're going to move from stuff that you know eventually to stuff that you don't know. So we have the gas, again, originally at equilibrium, and the demon, who has his two horns up there, inserts a partition. But this partition isn't quite the same as the partition on the previous slide because it has a door. It has this door right here. And what the demon is going to do is he's going to open the door when there are particles approaching from the left, and he's going to close the door when there are particles approaching from the right. And so, of course, over time, the number of particles in the right-hand side of the box is going to increase. So we can actually watch this particles bouncing around. This one here is actually on its way to approaching the door. So he opens the door, lets the particle through, and closes the door again. And so what we see again, that, as you would have expected, the number of particles on the right-hand side is increasing over time. And of course, if we allow this process to continue indefinitely, all particles are going to end up on the right-hand side of the box. And of course, what we see then is that the entropy of the system seems to be decreasing. And this seems, on the face of it, to be a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. The question really is then, what is it about the demon? Or what are we failing to model about the demon here assuming the second law of thermodynamics is true, that allows us to recover that second law? Now, a number of quite prominent and esteemed, and well, we can even say brilliant physicists, thought about this problem and thought about it for 100 years, and really never, all of them failed to identify what was really going on. That they would look at a particular model that they proposed and convince themselves that in that particular model there was no violation of the second law. But they couldn't provide a general purpose argument that applied always. And so Charlie Bennett, making use of Landauer's principle in 1982, finally was able to explain why any attempt to build Maxwell's demon is going to run afoul of the second law of thermodynamics. All right, so let's watch this again. Particle approaching. Now all the particles are on the right-hand side of the box. And the key point is what's going on up here, right? The demon, as these particles are approaching, is actually having to keep track of them, right? He's actually he has to process some information about the location of those particles in the box if he's to actually operate the door. And if he has a finite amount of memory, eventually he has to start forgetting things. Now, in some of the early days, people got confused by the fact that this being, that they were proposing that he was a conscious being, Maxwell's demon, that maybe that had something to do with it. Just imagine Maxwell's demon as a robot, right? It's controlled by a computer. And in a real box, there are an enormous number of particles. And so this demon is having to keep track of an enormous amount of information. In practice, he's going to have a finite memory, and eventually he's going to have to start forgetting things. And Landauer's principle then ensures that the global that entropy increases globally, because he has to keep track of at least one bit of information for each particle in the box, essentially. And so this is just kind of a moral, I suppose, or a motivating story that I wanted to show you that a problem that had really plagued physics for 100 years could be resolved in a very simple and very elegant way by looking at erasure. And the reason that people hadn't solved the book before was they were just asking the wrong question, not because they were lacking for the technical tools. All right. So now let's move on to quantum information theory. What I'd like to first tell you about in quantum information theory is one of the most basic observations and tools that we use all of the time. And this is what we call the Church of the Larger Hilbert Space. And again, I'm going to be using simple cartoons to illustrate what I'm talking about, just because the next few slides really are the basis for everything I'm going to tell you today. And so it may look extremely simple, but you know, pay attention, and the rewards will hopefully be great. So now we have a quantum system on some Hilbert space A. And throughout my talk, as is frequent in quantum information theory, I'm just going to assume that the Hilbert space is finite dimensional. And that quantum system is, in general, going to be in a mixed state that I call rho sub A. So I'm using these subscripts to label the systems that I'm talking about. Now, what happens when a particle visits the Church of Larger Hilbert space? What happens there is that the ecclesiastical authorities assign a heavenly partner to that particle A. So this is a quantum system with Hilbert space labeled by B, and the A and B systems are correlated in some way. And they're correlated in the following way. The overall system is pure, so we'll call it phi sub AB. It's the pure state of a composite system. And it has the property that when we trace over the B degrees of freedom, as we integrate out the B degrees of freedom, we recover the state on A. Now, quantum information theorists, I won't say anything, actually. So, the moral here is that, of course, when we're faced with a mixed state rho A, we can always act as if that mixed state comes from the pure state of a larger system, pure state phi sub AB. As you can see in quantum information theory, in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, the rituals of purification play a crucial role, as they do in all great world religions. Now, there's a technicality about purifications that is also going to be very important for my talk. And that is that purifications are essentially unique. And so if we fix this system B, it's true that all purifications are the same up to a local unitary transformation of the purifying space. And so I guess in this Church of Larger Hilbert space language, that means that if you've been purified both by an angel or a unicorn, it doesn't matter to you. These things are all the same up to some unitary transformation of heaven, I suppose.
You said if we fix B, they're unique?
You fix the Hilbert space of B.
Fix? Okay.
Yeah.
But fixing that is arbitrary?
If you actually have purifications of two different Hilbert spaces, then you could take the direct sum of those two and then relate them that way. So that's really just a toss-away technical point. Yeah.
Yeah, so if A is finite dimensional, is there a minimal dimensionality of the Hilbert space of B that you need?
Yeah, so in general, the minimum dimension is the rank of the density operator rho A.
So I'm still confused. Unique in what sense?
You're saying
there's only one possible B that exists that's equivalent to all others?
So if we look at these states phi sub AB, these pure states, if we have two purifications, call them phi and phi prime, of rho A, then those are related by a unitary transformation on B alone. I'll illustrate that in the next slide. So that's the formal sense. All right. So now I'd like to look at what happens when we talk about the purification of composite quantum systems. So let's assume now that we have a composite quantum system, so AC, and that the density operator of A time of AC is actually a product. So there are no correlations between the A system and the C system. Now, if A and C are sent to the Church of Larger Hilbert space, again, the ecclesiastical authorities can purify those quantum systems, actually here one at a time, right? Because the state on A and C is a product state. And so there are no dependencies between them. So we can purify the A system, and then we can purify the B system. And of course, the purified state is now going to have this product form, phi sub AB tensor psi sub CD, right? Simple enough. But something else could happen. If we have density operator rho A tensor sigma C, and we ask about the purification, if they're sent into the Church of Larger Hilbert space again, they can be assigned heavenly partners that are themselves correlated. They don't have to have that special structure that I just showed you on the previous slide. And so the overall state could have a much more complicated form. There could be correlations between C and D, between C and B. There could be correlations between B and D, and so on. I'm using these green lines to indicate, roughly speaking, some kind of correlation. Don't take them too seriously. All we can really say is that the overall state is a pure state of A, B, C, and D. And when we trace over the B and D degrees of freedom, we recover the state as we asked for in the beginning. But here's where this observation of uniqueness really comes into its own. Because we know that all purifications are related by unitary transformation on the purifying space, right? So there is a unitary on B and D that takes our previous purification and brings it to this one, which means that we can actually suppose that we actually apply the inverse of that unitary transformation. It's going to happen up here. We can actually disentangle, remove all of those extra correlations by acting on the B and D systems alone. That is, we can, if we had a generic purification that had correlations in all these different directions, by only acting on the purifying space, we can separate them out and recover a product state. And that's going to be used again and again and again in this talk. So are there questions about that? Because we will actually use this this observation. All right. So the art of forgetting, which is how to develop a terrible memory. What am I talking about when I talk about forgetting in quantum mechanics? I'm just going to illustrate it again with a cartoon. So suppose that we have Alice and we have Bob. They've made their first appearances at the talk, I suppose. And they have a composite quantum system. So here I'm saying that Alice has an A system, Bob has a B1, B2, B3. And Bob also has access to a trash can. And our question is, how can Bob unilaterally destroy correlations with Alice? And that's actually what I mean by forgetting. For me, forgetting is unilaterally destroying correlations. So what can he do? Well, he has his trash bin. He could throw all of his particles into the bin, right? If he throws all his particles into the bin, he no longer has any correlation with those particles, at least, you know, according to this diagram. But that's not really an interesting question, right? If we know that he can eliminate all his correlations by throwing all his particles into the bin, a more interesting question is, what is the minimal number of particles that he has to throw into the bin in order to eliminate this correlation? So here we're starting to ask the question, how hard is it for Bob to actually forget something? And we quantify that by how much he needs to throw away. So let's see what happens. If he throws away the first particle, there are correlations left. And now he's going to cleverly throw away the third particle. And as it turns out, the density operator of rho AB2, so if we only look at the A and B2 subsystems in this example, just postulating, that density operator is a product. So by throwing away the B1 and the B3 subsystems, he managed to actually destroy all his correlation. And he did this without having to throw all of his particles into the bin. Right? This is the crucial point, that if you're trying to destroy correlations, you don't always need to throw everything away, that you might be able to be a little bit more clever at that. So throwing two particles, he succeeded in eliminating correlations. So what I'd like to do now is go through that same cartoon, but in the Church of the Larger Hilbert space picture. Because something very interesting happens, that this process of forgetting, which, as I said at the beginning of my talk, seems to be completely useless, when you view it from the rarefied heights of the Church of the Larger Hilbert space, starts to look a little bit more useful. So instead of a trash bin, we're going to upgrade that to Charlie's magical bucket of particles. And in that bucket, Charlie's actually going to start with the quantum system C, which purifies A, B1, B2, and B3. So the starting state now is going to be a pure state of the whole system. And we know that if Charlie throws his B1 and B3 into the bin, well, what happens? If he throws B1 into the bin, there's still some correlation up here. But if he throws B3 into the bin, we saw that eliminates all correlation between Alice and Bob. So now, all of the correlation between Alice and Bob has been eliminated, and the only way, and somehow all of the correlation has been stuffed into Charlie's bin. Well, what good is that? We just have some complicated looking state now. But we can make use of our observation that all purifications are essentially unique, up to a unitary transformation of the purifying space. So here, the purifying space of A and B2 is Charlie's magical bucket of particles. Yeah?
maybe misunderstanding, but just looking at the diagram, it looks like there could be some correlation still between Erlis and Bob, at least classical.
Oh, yeah. So I guess I haven't really explained, or I haven't defined exactly what I mean by these green lines. And the green line, it's actually hard in general to define what you would mean by such green lines, because quantum correlations don't map onto such a graph structure very well. So just interpret that as being that if there is a line, if you look at the bipartite reduced density operator for those two systems, then there is correlation, and otherwise there is not. So it doesn't say anything about transitivity. Yeah. All right. So now we know that all purifications are unique. We know that all purifications are unique up to a transformation in Charlie's lab. So let's apply that transformation. Charlie allows his particles to interact in some particular way. And then what we see is, of course, because the state on Alice and V2 is a product, the state in Charlie's magical bucket of particles, or the purified state, can itself also be made a product, just as we saw when we were talking about the Church of Larger Hilbert space. And so the effect is that Charlie now holds uncorrelated purifications of both Alice's system, there's the purification for Alice's system, and what's left in Bob's lab. Here's the purification for what's left in Bob's lab. And so this is starting to look a little bit more useful, maybe. We'll interpret it very soon. So on the left we have before, on the right hand we have after. So before we have a general tripartite pure entangled state. It can be correlated in any way we want, we're not specifying. And on the right hand side we have something that's very special. We have only pure state entanglement between Alice and Charlie and pure state entanglement between Bob and Charlie. Now we can observe that Alice was entirely passive through this whole process, and so her state doesn't change. And so what's actually happening is that while originally her purification of Alice was held by both Bob and Charlie, at the end it's held by Charlie alone. So Bob has managed to transfer his entanglement to Charlie in this process. Yeah?
Now if I not understood something, this is a very special situation where there is no entanglement between Alice and V2 to start with.
Oh yes, that's
it. Had it been the generic case.
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
There would have been no further conclusion.
Yeah, so we're going to have to deal with the general case. I was just dealing with the cartoon so you can see what happens in the cartoon. And something quite remarkable is going to happen in the general case. So there's this transfer of entanglement, and also there's this establishment of bipartite entanglement between Charlie and Bob. And in quantum information theory, we call that distillation, that Charlie and Bob have managed to distill pure entanglement through this process. All right, so time for some formulas. How much does Bob need to send? And so now we're talking about the general case, so you were asking. Again, in order to get nice formulas in quantum information theory, we often restrict ourselves to special cases in which nice formulas apply. Similar conclusions often apply if you don't restrict to the special case, but then the formulas aren't as nice. So let's restrict to the special case, where now the state shared between Alice, Bob, and Charlie is an n-fold tensor product of some starting state. So they have n copies of some generic, or not generic, some arbitrary state phi. In quantum information theory, again, we measure the uncertainty in a quantum state, most usually, by the von Neumann entropy. And so my notation here is going to be the entropy of the A system for rho is defined to be the entropy of the rho A reduced density operator minus the trace of rho A log rho A. And again, in quantum information theory, if we want to talk about correlations, at least personally, my favorite measure of correlation is this thing called the quantum mutual information. And it's just this linear combination of entropies, the entropy of the A system plus the entropy of the B system minus the joint entropy. Now, you might wonder, why would we measure correlations that way? Like, physicists normally will look at some two-point correlation function or something. The good thing about the quantum mutual information is that we don't need to ask the question, are the measurement outcomes for two observables for these two states at different locations correlated? If this quantum mutual information is equal to zero, then we know that there's no way to measure correlations between the A and B systems, that any observable you choose to measure will reveal no information or no correlation. And conversely, if the mutual information is non-zero, there exists an observable that will detect those correlations. And so it's kind of the final word on the existence of correlations between the A and B subsystems. So it's zero if and only if the state is a product. And the only other thing you need to know is that it's maximal for what we call EBITs. So an EBIT, for those of you who aren't quantum information theorists, is just a quantum state of this form. Oops. And for such a state, the quantum mutual information evaluates to 2, and if you have m of them, it evaluates to 2m. All right, so now let's actually do some quantum information theory. Now, our goal is to destroy correlations between Alice and Bob. Right? Now, they start off with a certain amount of correlation. And as a quantum information theorist, I'm going to measure that with the mutual information between the A system and the B system. So Alice and Bob start off with an amount of correlation, which is n times the correlation in a single copy of phi. Simple enough. And the goal is for Bob to unilaterally destroy his correlations with Alice. Right? So at the end of the day, the amount of mutual information is going to be something really small if we succeed here. Now, we also know that each qubit, each two-state system that Bob discards, has the potential to eliminate at most 2 bits of correlation. Why is that? Well, it's essentially for this reason, that e-bits have the maximal value of mutual information, and it's 2. So if you throw away a qubit, the most that could, you know, in the best case, you're throwing away half of an e-bit, and the mutual information is going down by 2. And in general, you might actually reduce it by less. So ideally, the number of qubits that Bob should actually send to Charlie here is going to be 1/2 the mutual information between Alice and Bob. And so this is actually more or less a proof of the necessity of sending this many qubits, or of discarding this many qubits in order to succeed. The fairly amazing thing, related to what Lee was asking, is that this is in general achievable also. That there's a protocol that will actually succeed in destroying that correlation by discarding, in which Bob discards to leading order exactly this many qubits, which is quite remarkable. So Bob, you were asking, how does Bob select which systems to discard? Well, I haven't told you how he selects, but I can tell you exactly in general how many qubits he needs to discard. And then there's a question, how does Bob choose which qubits? And this is kind of an important point. At the end of the talk, I'm going to want to apply these ideas a little bit to, or at least speculate on their application to physics rather than just quantum information theory. And the question of which qubits need to be discarded is actually an important one. And the answer is pretty simple. You just choose qubits at random, and you throw those ones away, and that's going to do the job. Now, what do I mean by throwing them away at random? For the aficionados, what I actually mean is you first project onto the high probability subspace of B tensor N, what we call the typical subspace in quantum information theory, and then you apply a random unitary transformation selected according to the Haar measure, and then you just throw away any qubits you want. And that's actually going to achieve this optimal rate that I told you about. This is kind of surprising because it means that in order for Bob to destroy his correlations with Alice, he doesn't need to do anything special. He doesn't need to worry about the correlation of his structure of his state. All he has to do is say, well, how much correlation am I trying to get rid of? And once he knows how much correlation he's trying to get rid of, he just throws away that many qubits that he's done. So it's a very kind of generic, Bob's actions here are very generic. They don't depend very much on what he wants to do. So the final accounting, the investment, how much does Bob need to discard? If he wants to destroy correlation with Alice, he needs to throw away a number of qubits which is proportional to his initial mutual information. And what are the rewards? Well, at the end of the day, Charlie is holding Alice's purification. And there's this entanglement between Bob and Charlie that I told you about. And the amount of it is actually proportional to the mutual information between Bob and Charlie before they started. This, again, is something that if you were a quantum information theorist, you would say that if the world is harmonious and just and good, that's the number that it would be. Because the amount of entanglement Bob and Charlie end up with is proportional to the amount of correlation they started with, which is pretty sensible. Right? They started off with this much correlation, and they end up with that many e-bits. So nothing has gotten lost in the process. All right, so now what good is this? As I said, I was telling you about forgetting. What are we going to do with forgetting? Now we have to place this in the context, the larger context of quantum information theory. Now up to about, I'd say, 2003, quantum information theory, and here I really mean specifically the asymptotic theory of quantum information, so trying to set, you know, the generalization of Shannon's theory to the quantum mechanical setting. It was really in disarray. It was a productive disarray, but it was disarray. We had ways of solving many of the problems that we're interested in, but we didn't really see strong connections between them. So the kinds of problems that we were interested in were, for example, on the left-hand side, these are things that deal with starting with some kind of noisy state. So two parties, Bob and Charlie, started with a noisy state, meaning noisy entanglement. They might want to produce high-quality entanglement, because that's a useful thing in quantum information theory. That's entanglement distillation. They might want to use these states for teleportation or superdense coding, which you might have heard of. On the right-hand side, there are things you might want to do with a channel. You might want to send quantum data through a channel, as I was saying at the beginning, in such a way that it doesn't get molested. Or you might want to send classical data through that channel, with or without entanglement as an extra resource. It was sort of this zoo of things that you might be interested in trying to do. And what Devatai, Caro, and Winter did, which was fantastic, is they observed that these could be organized, at least some of the things we were interested in, could be organized into families. And all you needed to do for each family was solve one problem, and all the others basically followed for free. And that problem that they could solve was, on the left-hand side, the mother, they called it, and on the right-hand side, the father. There was a clear genealogical motivation for this. Now, where does forgetting fit into this picture? Well, this unifying picture of Devatai, Caro, and Winter was great. It started to present the existence of these families, but there's a division down the middle, right? The state protocols and the channel protocols didn't seem to have anything to connect them. Well, that's actually forgetting. Forgetting is the primitive that's actually going to join all of these things together. And moreover, it does a lot more than just these protocols that people were worried about in 2003. If you run the forgetting protocol backwards in time, that accomplishes something called channel simulation. If you want to figure out the ways to use channels in which there are multiple inputs in a single output, so the quantum mechanical generalization of essentially many cell phones trying to communicate to a single base station, interfering with each other, experiencing noise along the way, and so on. Correlated distributed compression, state merging, broadcast channels, so channels that have a single input, many outputs, all of these sorts of things. Again, the zoo is getting much, 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 much larger, much larger. And you might worry about this, I've run out of space on the screen. But what's great is that actually, there's not actually, once you understand forgetting, a whole lot of extra work required to solve all of these other problems now. All of these other problems follow using relatively simple techniques from the basic forgetting observation, which is fantastic because it means that the larger theory of quantum information can be put together like tinker toys out of this basic component. And I ran out of space here, but more recently there was a paper by Igor Devatak and John Yard called Redistributing Quantum Information. That was a new primitive, and I was worried it didn't fit on the slide. But it turns out that with three applications of forgetting, you get their new result too. So it really does seem that this forgetting is really a basic primitive for asymptotic quantum information theory. That almost all the things that we want to do can be put together by just forgetting the right stuff. So I obviously don't have time to tell you about all of these connections, and some of them get pretty esoteric. But I'd like to give you the flavor of the way that these connections work. And so I'll start off by just telling you about entanglement distillation. So the formal setting of entanglement distillation, we've discussed it before, I've discussed it informally before. We have Bob and we have Charlie, and they start off with some mixed quantum mechanical state. So rho bc, and I'm going to postulate they have many copies of it. And their goal is to extract e-bits, right? So extract high-quality entanglement that they can use in some future quantum information protocol. Now, the rules of the game is that Bob and Charlie are allowed local operations. They can do whatever they want, but they're only allowed to communicate over the phone. Because if we allow them to somehow send quantum mechanical data with high fidelity to each other, they can establish as much entanglement as they wanted. So in order to make this a sensible problem, we have to say they can communicate by phone only, so no quantum mechanical communication, and they can do whatever they want in their own labs. And the question is, what is the very best way for them to extract e-bits in this process? Well, if you remember, the forgetting protocol does exactly that. It establishes e-bits between Bob and Charlie. But there was a problem, because if you remember, Bob had to transmit his qubits to Charlie in the forgetting protocol. Right? So that breaks the rule that only classical communication is allowed. But we can get around that, because we can implement quantum communication in quantum information theory using teleportation. Teleportation is a way to send qubits, to send quantum data, using classical communication and entanglement. So the accounting is, to transmit one qubit, you need two classical bits and one e-bit. And so in this setting, if we use the forgetting protocol, the forgetting protocol establishes this much entanglement between Bob and Charlie, but consumed this much quantum communication. So if we consume, if we implement that quantum communication using teleportation, we have to say that we've actually consumed e-bits in the process of the protocol as well. So the protocol generates e-bits and it consumes them at the same time. And the net rate is just the difference between the number generated and the number consumed, and it works out to this difference of entropies. Well, what that formula is doesn't matter, but I can tell you that up to some considerations that I'm not going to go into right now, that's the optimal rate at which Alice and Bob can establish e-bits if we only allow Bob to communicate with Alice using classical communication. And so this forgetting protocol really shows us the best way that we know how to distill entanglement, which is in many ways the basic primitive of quantum information theory. Well, I got a bit ahead of myself there. I should say that the only thing we need to know about this function is that it can be both positive and negative. And so that was a real conundrum for a long time in quantum information theory. Oppenheim, Horodetsky, and Winter basically resolved the issue of why this quantity can be both positive and negative, and has everything to do with entanglement distillation, as I've been telling you here. Winter is a very modest kind of guy. He doesn't like to be flattered too much. But I think that this flatters his modesty. The fact that that information quantity could be both positive and negative led to this inspired headline about him. All right, so now back to the complicated map of our landscape of quantum information theory. I've shown you how we can use the forgetting protocol to do useful things if we're manipulating quantum states. And that's maybe kind of sensible, because the forgetting protocol started with a quantum state. Some stuff happened, and it ended up with a quantum state, right? So it's very much in the spirit of the left-hand side of the diagram. Now, the right-hand side of the diagram is about quantum channels, about things that we can actually do if we have a medium for communicating, and that medium is quantum mechanical. And it's not so clear how forgetting comes into that picture. So what I'd like to tell you about is this entanglement-assisted classical or quantum capacity, actually, and how forgetting gives us insight into how that works. So I could say the entanglement-assisted capacity was first dealt with by Bennett, Shor, Smolin, and Thapliyal. So this is really just it's giving a new way of it, a new proof. It's not giving the first proof of how this works. Now, before we get going, I'd like to tell you about the setting for entanglement-assisted communication so that you can see what's going on. The setting is that we have an Alice and we have a Bob, and I'm using these dotted lines to indicate their local systems, and time is running from left to right in this diagram. And again, the green lines indicate some kind of quantum information propagating. So the resource that they have available to them is a quantum channel, taking input from Alice's system and generating output on Bob's system. So a quantum channel is essentially just a linear map that takes density operators to density operators. Essentially, the most general thing that, up to some caveats, the most general noise model for what is actually going to be experienced by a quantum system if it interacts with an environment. So that's the resource that they have available to them. And I'm also saying that it's entanglement assisted. So we're just going to postulate that Alice and Bob have some free entanglement that they can use, and maybe it's going to help them. So this is how I'm indicating entanglement. At some point in the past, there was a system that interacted. Part of it went to Alice, and part of it went to Bob. And those are correlated in a quantum mechanical way. So that's a resource that can be used in this process. Now, there's also entanglement with the reference. Because you can ask yourself the question, if I want to see whether or not quantum data has successfully been sent through some communication system, how do I check? What does it mean for quantum data to be successfully sent through a communication system? It means that entanglement is preserved. That's the definition. Sending quantum data is sending entanglement. And so we're going to verify that Alice successfully sends her entanglement with the reference system to Bob. And what are they going to do? Well, these are the basic pieces. Alice is going to start off by performing some kind of encoding operation. So her current encoding operation is going to include her half of the reference entanglement, so the stuff that she's trying to send successfully, and her half of that entanglement that she shared with Bob. Right, so we have two inputs, and the output just gets sent to the quantum channel. At Bob's end, once he gets all of his stuff, he gets the output of the channel and the entanglement he started with, he's going to perform a decoding operation. And again, we allow this to be anything permitted by quantum mechanics. And at the end of the day, if this is supposed to work, the output of the decoding should be a high-quality entangled state with the reference system. So Alice successfully transmitted her entanglement with the reference system to Bob. So this is the picture. This is what we're trying to do. And again, you might not at first glance think it doesn't look like it has a lot to do with forgetting. But it's going to, well, the way that the connection to forgetting is going to be through understanding the structure of this noisy channel. Because remember, a noisy quantum mechanical channel comes from the fact that the quantum system interacted with other degrees of freedom and we ignored them. We don't have access to them. And so let's just model the whole channel by a unitary transformation from Alice to Bob and some arbitrarily large environment system that captures all of the degrees of freedom. And so the output is not just not to Bob, but there's also an environment there. Okay, that's what we have available to us. And the question is, who needs to do the forgetting in this problem? Well, what we want to do is we want to establish entanglement between the reference and Bob. And at this point in time, we can see, well, we have a pure state between the reference, environment, and two pieces that belong to Bob. And so what we need to have happen is we have to have the reference forget everything there is to forget about the environment. Because if the reference and the environment are uncorrelated, then there is a unitary transformation on the Bob systems that will actually separate out that entanglement, just like in the forgetting protocol. So in the Church of Larger Hilbert space picture, what we have, if R and E form a tensor product state, then there is a unitary transformation on the Bob 2 system. So there's a Bob decoding that will separate out the entanglement that's required. And as it turns out, if you actually, I'm not going to go through the details here, but if we actually figure out exactly what the mapping is onto forgetting, then the encoding that Bob needed to perform in the forgetting protocol has to actually happen between the reference and Bob 2. So if we apply Bob's map from the original forgetting protocol, we call it V, and we apply it here, that's going to do exactly what we need in order to perform this entanglement assisted communication. But allowing V to be performed up there is kind of like putting the fox in charge of the hen nest, right? Because we're allowing this joint transformation between the reference and Bob 2. But our goal was to determine whether or not the reference entanglement was sent correctly. So if we allow arbitrary interactions between the reference and Bob, then Bob could just generate huge amounts of entanglement with the reference. So this is against the rules. This just is not allowed to, it's against the rules, we can't do it. And so everything would seem to be ruined and failed, but we have my favorite identity of quantum information theory, which that if we call this phi, then if we have a matrix A acting on one half of phi, that's equal to the transpose of the same matrix acting on the other half. This is two-line calculation, but it has all kinds of fantastic consequences. So here we have a big unitary transformation acting on halves of entangled states. So we can apply the transpose of V on the other halves, just like this. And so what was an impermissible operation now becomes permissible, because the transpose can now be applied by Alice at her encoding step. And that's the whole thing. So this is essentially how we connect entangled assisted communication and forget. That was a little taste of the applications of forgetting in quantum information theory. So now I'd like to move to what I would call the more speculative part of the talk. And because I think that what we've been learning about forgetting one of the messages that we've learned from studying these forgetting protocols is that if you want to see how information propagates in a physical system, sometimes it's useful to look at where it's not. That's basically the message there, right? If we want to make sure that the entanglement has been transferred from Bob to Charlie, we just make sure that it's not with Bob, and by the process of elimination, it must have been with Charlie. And maybe that's useful for thinking about physical systems. So I'd just like to talk about random dynamics and information leakage. Suppose that we have some quantum system B, and this is somehow a strongly interacting system, and I don't want to be too specific about what it is. So the internal dynamics, the internal degrees of freedom are strongly coupled. And in my information theorist's view, I'm just going to use the fact that it's spinning to indicate that there's some kind of strong interaction taking place there. And I'm just going to postulate that it's also radiating, right? So there's stuff coming off of this system. And let's just conduct a little thought experiment. So we have Alice here. And what Alice does is she prepares an EBIT, right? She prepares an EPR pair. So there are two, she has a, two parts to her system, the A part and the part that I haven't labeled. And she, let's just suppose that she drops the A part into this strongly interacting system B. We can now ask the question, how long must Alice wait until the information about A gets radiated, right? Now, before today, you might have thought, well, is that even really a well-defined question? What do you mean by the information about A getting radiated? But if we've learned anything today, it's that we now have a good definition for what it means for the information about A to be radiated. And that is that the equivalent question is, how long until the orange blob has forgotten about A? Until the state of A and B is a tensor product state. Because we know by our purification picture that if that is the case, then the purification of A has to lie in what I'll call C, which is all these radiated particles. Right? So that we don't actually necessarily, if we want to ask, answer the question, is the information about A in the radiated particles, we don't actually have to necessarily look for it there. We can just confirm that the information about A is not in B, and if it is, then it has to be in C. Right? That's what we've been learning today. But there's something kind of surprising, which is that, is to think about the answer to this question. How long until the orange blob is forgotten about A? And my claim is that for sufficiently mixing dynamics, the information about A is released almost immediately. So think back to the description of the forgetting protocol. What needed to happen in there? B is our Bob, right? Bob needed to perform a random unitary transformation. That's the mixing dynamics. So as long as the amount of time is larger than the internal mixing time. And then he just sends whatever particles he wants, whichever qubits he wants, to Charlie. That after this random unitary transformation, all degrees of freedom are equivalent, right? And so what we found is the very first ones, that the very first degrees of freedom that Bob sent to Charlie actually carried away the information about A. And that does seem kind of surprising, because if we have this radiating system, you might imagine, well, the internal dynamics are very mixing. And it would seem plausible that we'd have to wait until all B had basically, or you might worry that this internal mixing would cause the information about A to get hopelessly lost inside of B. And the only way that would come out is that if B actually radiated it all away. And the message of today's talk is actually that something exactly the opposite could occur. That the strongly mixing dynamics cause the information about A to come out first, even though there's nothing special about A. So it seems almost contradictory, but this is exactly what the calculations underlying what I've been telling you about today tells us. Yeah.
Is this true even if B has a dimensionality much, much larger than the dimensionality of A?
Yes. Yes. So it remains true. So there's an important technical point that I've glossed over a little bit. That I said that the first step is that Bob has to project onto the high probability subspace of his system.
And so B has to reach some kind of equilibrium or randomization.
Exactly. After A finds it. Yeah. Or before. So it could, what could, actually the way to think about this is maybe that the B system is in some kind of equilibrium situation and then Alice drops in her particle. Because provided that the B system is highly entangled with the exterior degrees of freedom at the starting point, then there's nothing that needs to be done. So, yeah, but that's a very important point.
But quantitatively, if B is made of n qubit, how many qubits do I need?
So what it's actually going to be is, assuming that B was at equilibrium beforehand, it's going to be something like the dimension of A. The dimension of A over epsilon, where epsilon is some measure of the fidelity that you want. Because the information, there is a sense in which the information does leak out. So these things are always approximate, but you can fix you can fix your quality parameter, your epsilon, and say, well, I want this to be good to within one in a million, and then it's going to be the dimension of A over a million, and the number of qubits is the logarithm of that. So it really can be the case that it's independent of the size of B. Now, if B is not in equilibrium, then I can write down formulas that specify the amount of time you have to wait, or at least bound the amount of time in terms of some measure of the fluctuations in the eigenvalues of the B density operator. So that comes into it, but I didn't want to get too technical, but we can discuss that.
Okay. So you're saying that the amount of time only depends on the error parameters, not on the dimensionality of B?
Yep. Okay. Let me be correct.
I mean, force-efficiently mixing dynamics.
Force-efficiently mixing dynamics and a B, which is, say, originally maximally mixed. Right? So if B was made, so if you form B somehow out of halves BPR pairs that were correlated with the exterior. Most of you probably see where I'm going with this, but let's just, again, part of the message of my talk has been to show you the same thing, kind of reinterpret it in different ways. So let's see what this might potentially tell us. Again, this is the speculative part of the talk, about potential lessons for black hole information loss. So here I'd like C to represent, again, in my toy model finite dimensional picture, the rest of the universe. B is some black hole degrees of freedom. Let's just assume that we have a starting point in which the pure state is, or that the initial state is pure between C, B and C. Hawking has told us that we have thermal Hawking radiation, and that over time the mass of the black hole has to shrink. Right. So we have thermal Hawking radiation, right? Information theorist's schematic picture, and at the end of the day, at least it seems that what we have in our universe is radiation, but no black hole, because the black hole has fully evaporated, and there's nothing left. And there's a standard question here, right, which is the final state of the universe mixed or pure? Corresponding to asking the question, can we write down a dynamics which is reversible or unitary, or is that impossible? And this is really an all or nothing question. Of course, even those people who will specify that they think that the final state is mixed, that general relativity kind of worked wins out in the end here, would probably concede that some amount of information, some small amount of information leaks out. But no one really knows the answer to this question. And we can't answer this question today, but what we can actually do is we can say, well, here's a new question, some interesting middle ground between these two extremes. We can ask, is the final state of some particular, or of some radiation, purified by the rest of the universe? So we can imagine capturing some radiation. So I'll just say A, and I'll call that an A, or I'll call this radiated system A. And we could ask, is the purification of A present in the C degrees of freedom? Has a purification of A gotten out? And what we've learned, again, in this talk, is that it's not necessary for the overall state of the universe to be pure in order for that to be the case. That information can leak out, and all the information can leak out about A, without having a pure state for the rest of the universe. And in fact, it's not even necessary to wait for the black hole to completely evaporate. Right? We never actually, the whole message from the beginning of the talk was that Bob doesn't need to throw away all his particles, he just needs to throw away some of them. And the question is, what was the minimum? And so we can now say, even if the black hole hasn't fully evaporated, is some small subsystem of the radiation A purified by the rest of the universe? And at least the toy model calculations that we've been doing today suggest that if you believe that the black hole evaporation process is ultimately unitary, then there is some time scale under which the answer to this question will be yes, even though the entire, if we look at the radiation as a whole, the radiation, or the rest of the universe will be mixed. Now, there's a final observation that I haven't talked about today, which I find to be particularly, and even more strangely, maybe even troubling. So suppose that we actually partition the output degrees of freedom. So again, in this finite dimensional picture, we imagine that we have a system of the form A tensor A2, tensor A3, and there's going to be some huge number. Let's suppose that these are all qubits or something. Now, I was modeling the black hole dynamics by a random unitary transformation, and clearly there's no difference between the first A and the second A and the third A and the fourth A. Right? It's going to be true that for each one of these, averaged over different random unitary transformations, with high probability the information will have come out. Now, concentration of measure effects in the unitary group actually imply that it's going to be simultaneously true with high probability, that the information about A came out, the information about A2 came out, the information about A3 came out, that all of these subsystems in which we partitioned the output radiation can simultaneously be purified, even though the overall state is mixed. And so the statement would be that the small subsystems, if we only looked at small subsystems, but looked at every single one of them, in some partition, all of that information could have, this is something that quantum information theory is telling us is at least in principle possible, all that information could have leaked out, even though we know that the overall state is highly mixed. And so for larger composite systems, if we looked at A and A2 together, the information might not have come out. Yeah.
Okay, so is the final truth, if I have a large number n of e bits.
Yeah.
And I separate them into two groups.
Mm-hmm.
And then, which is one of each. And then over here, I make a random unitary transformation. Then this state over here is purified.
You apply random unitary transformation, and you take off a couple of qubits. Yeah. No.
So the Hopkin radiation is this half of the qubits.
Yes.
This half of the e bits.
So you're thinking about a picture like this, right?
So I have a large number, right? And then on the left-hand side, I make a random unitary transformation.
So.
For I think what you're claiming to be relevant for the black hole problem would have to then be true that the right-hand side is then pure problem.
So
which is, I think, not what you're claiming.
Yeah. So we apply. Suppose there's a random unitary transformation, then some small system comes out.
Nothing comes out. The radiation is the half of the e-bits.
No, okay, so clearly if there's only a unitary transformation on the left-hand side and nothing comes out, then there's no information leaked.
Yes, I don't think that this is relevant for the black hole
problem. Okay, so the question is, I think, ultimately, so... There can be no information leakage if there's no coupling between the interior and exterior degrees of freedom. So the question is that in this model, I'm assuming the existence of some kind of coupling between the interior and exterior degrees of freedom. I'm not specifying what it is, but I'm saying at some point the semi-classical approximation breaks down. And some amount of information leaks out from the interior to the exterior. And the point is that if that semi-classical approximation breaks down at some point, you could ask, well, what are the consequences of that? If it breaks down, but then only a tiny amount of information leaks out, then maybe it would be, in principle, impossible to recover any information about what fell into the black hole. But the message here is that if that approximation breaks down at some point, and even a tiny amount of information leaks out, then that in the form of a very small number of qubits here that have been coupled to the interior degrees of freedom, then it will in principle be true, or it will be true again in this toy model that those few qubits that leak out, coupled with the exterior degrees of freedom, will purify. Or will contain the information about any small system that you allow to fall into the black hole in the first place. So this, you can see this as a kind of exploration of the consequences of the breakdown of that approximation, that there would be that the horizon is really that the black hole is truly black, right?
Let's talk about that.
Okay. So when you
talk about taking some subsystem and throw them away, are you doing something like are you also mixing the subsystem, like changing the tensor for example, the composition, or you just have a predefined set of subsystems and just throw some number away?
So in my initial cartoon, I was really just having Bob throw some away. But what I'm really doing is I'm imagining there's some tensor product decomposition, and then there's a random unitary transformation, and that effectively blurs all of the boundaries between, that restores the symmetry that what is lacking if you impose some tensor decomposition at the beginning.
Because this may apply also here. I mean, it is true that there is some type of tensor product decomposition that if you throw away, you have a pure system. But if you predefine the tensor product decomposition, it may not be true, right?
Oh, well, so the important point, though, is that the unitary transformation, so with respect to my problem, I really only needed a decomposition into an A system, a B system, and a C system. And what I need is that this transformation acts on the B system. So what I'm really postulating is that there's some internal dynamics in B. I don't know what they are, but I'm just going to model them by a random unitary transformation. But I don't need to have any kind of I'm not specifying the nature of the interaction between B and C or between B and A. Well, implicitly kind of between B and A, because the A systems are systems that have come out of B. But that there's only really dynamics internal to B.
So yeah. Maybe this is the wrong question, but if you want to purify n e bits, let's say, so how many bits would have to come out in order to do that? Is there some asymptotic?
Oh yeah, so if you want to purify n e bits,
yeah.
Then you're basically going to have n over 2 qubits come out. That's if you want the whole thing to be purified collectively. But if you want them to be purified individually, then it's going to be some constant number.
I see.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Right. Is it
an
over 2 or
it's actually an over 2.
Good. How's that even enough to purify
it? Well, this is the usual factor of 2.
Yeah.
Is that right? It's the super dense coding factor of 2.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Are there other questions? Okay, well, I'm glad that generated some discussion. I would very much if anyone wants to talk about this further, I would actually very much appreciate anybody's comments on these observations. And that's actually all that I wanted to tell you. So this forgetting primitive, which at first glance seemed to be pretty useless, not really worth studying quantum information theory, turns out to be kind of the key to unifying lots of the protocols that we had before, and once we unify those protocols of actually generating all kinds of new protocols that solve all kinds of new problems that we'd like to solve. It's not that hard. That's another advantage of this, that if quantum information theory has been simplified and made a lot easier through the introduction of this primitive. But my real hope is that this might actually be useful for studying physical systems. And in order to do that, we're going to have to develop a sort of more sophisticated one-shot version of quantum information theory, because most of quantum information theory relies on these special states, like these tensor product states that I've been telling you about throughout this talk. But I think there's room for some very interesting future developments that involve developing one-shot information theory and then tracking information this way in real physical systems. So thanks for your attention. That's it.
You had the slide where you had the forgetting, and then you had all these arrows emanating out from that. And is the forgetting protocol, does it appear to be unique in the sense of having this completeness property, or is it possible that one of the other primitives could also be?
One of the other ones is equivalent. So the channel simulation primitive that I told you about, because it really is just running forgetting backwards in time, 6 of one, half a dozen of the other, right? So those two are equivalent. But I think that pretty well all the other examples there are special cases. Certainly on the right-hand side, all of those channel coding problems, those that are actually, you could think of them as ultimately proving forgetting, if you had a direct proof of one of those, as proving forgetting for some special class of states. But it's actually easier just to prove forgetting directly for all states. So I think that channel simulation and forgetting are the only ones in that family that are really that generate the whole thing.
So can you prove that other ones don't give you the whole class, or that if you assume this primitive, it doesn't?
Well, that's a computer scientist's way of thinking, I guess. Because from I sort of thought about that at first, and I was thinking, is that even a really well defined question?
Okay.
Because what we're doing is we're just saying, given one of these protocols, we get an easy proof of the existence of the other one. But we don't need to assume the existence of the protocol to prove that those things work. So I'm not sure that it's really a well-defined question.
So you don't really
question.
Have a well-defined notion of reduction here. It's just a question of organizing the proofs.
Yeah, although maybe it would be interesting to see if there'd be a way to formulate such a theory. Mm-hmm.
Stated, but I think didn't quite prove why it is that Bob just does this random unitarian and throws away what comes first. Can you give some intuition that a lot of things seem to hinge on that?
Yeah, well, I think that the intuition is really, again, that a qubit, there are two competing intuitions here. And as long as you restrict yourself to living in one world, everything makes a lot of sense. So if you think that one qubit is capable of carrying away 2 bits worth of information, the kind of super dense coding bound, and then you say, OK, well, suppose that I apply a random unitary transformation inside Bob's system. Then I have some very highly entangled state inside Bob's system. And I know that an e-bit can carry away, if I take half of an e-bit, that carries away two bits of information. But if I have some very highly entangled state, it seems plausible that I will again actually succeed in carrying away 2 bits of information, even though it's not formally an e-bit, it's something very highly entangled because I applied a random unitary. And so if you restrict yourself to thinking in those terms, and you say, well, how much correlation do I need to eliminate? And the amount is the mutual information. And so the number of qubits or the rate of qubits that need to be released is going to be the mutual information divided by 2. And that's how I like to think about it, because I don't get confused if I think in those terms. But trying to think in terms of the opposite picture, which would be the picture of looking at the rate at which information increases in Charlie's lab, that I think is harder to, it's harder to develop solid intuition about that.
So the random unitary is supposed to be so random that it's a maximally entangled state effectively.
Effectively, yeah. Of course, when you say maximally entangled, you have to, I was fudging a little bit because I didn't say maximally entangled with what. But at least internally to Bob's system, a random unitary transformation is going to generate as much entanglement as you can. Now, one thing I didn't want to get into in this talk, it's not really necessary for this to be a Hara random unitary transformation. But the kinds of pseudo-random unitary transformations that Joe, for example, has been thinking about, I think are good enough. And those are much more plausible on physical grounds. That a huge random unitary is actually something that physically is never going to happen, right? It would take exponential time. But we only actually need the first few moments of the Hara measure to get this to work.
So, Patrick, if you threw n bits into a black hole, let's say, and then we're interested in when is some specific bit x of I going to come out, that's not going to come out with the first, you know, 1 or 2 qubits that we're making in the black hole, right? So maybe, you know, I mean, it can't by the whole of them. So maybe one way of thinking of these results is that it shows like that there's a very big difference between recovering information and purifying a state.
So it will come out, I think, and it doesn't violate the Hallow bound. Of course, saying that this is true for a black hole, of course, I think it's, yeah.
it's going arbitrary, so yeah.
Yeah, like a lump of coal, or whatever it is.
What?
A lump of coal.
Very yeah, common. A lump of coal.
So Alice's system, here's the issue, right? That if you think that Alice has a large string, right, or many e-bits, and she drops halves of all those e-bits into the black hole. Then if somebody wants to get a particular bit from that string back, then they have to use Alice's other e-bits. So we sort of have Alice here, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the rest. And then there's going to be stuff coming out. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to ask, when does the stuff coming out contain a purification of, say, the I e-bit here? But all of my analysis requires that when you say stuff coming out, it's everything in the rest of the universe that is not the black hole.
Right. Well, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
if you
exactly.
make this assumption, now we're talking about a purification problem, which is different from just the random access coding problem.
Yeah, exactly. So you would actually need to
right.
give...
If we didn't know the string, and we just wanted to say, all right, well, what is x of I? Then, you know, given this one bit that's come out from the lump of coal...
Then you won't get it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But if you know the rest of the script, you want to find out x of I.
Yeah. yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
maybe you already alluded to it with your pseudo-randomness, but if I'm Bob and I put a very finite memory and I want to perform one of these random unitary operations on an enormous Hilbert space, how easy is it for me to do that?
Oh, it's not so bad. So now we're leaving black holes and just talking about the communication context. Then what you need is a unitary two design. So Bob can, what you can do is you can apply a random Clifford group element. And we know that one way to select a random Clifford group element is to do a random walk on the Clifford group using generators like CNOTS and Hadamard and Space Gates. And that just needs to run for some polynomial amount of time and the number of qubits, I think n cubed. So there are probably better ways, but we know that at least there's a polynomial time Bob encoding. We don't know anything about the Charlie decoding at this point. That's, I guess, a project that we want to try to figure out the answer to. Yeah?
I'm still a little confused about, he has to throw away I over 2 random bits. Does that mean he has to throw away exactly I over 2 random bits?
At least that many.
At least that many.
Yeah, any number larger than that is good.
Okay, so then can one quantify if he throws away a little bit less, how much correlation is left over?
Yeah, that's actually a very interesting question. And you get into... So if you just look at the quantum mutual information, then if you haven't actually sent enough, if Bob hasn't discarded enough, and you then, well, if you look at Charlie's quantum mutual information with Alice, that's just going to climb linearly with the number of qubits that Bob discards. So it's going up and up and up. So it's what you'd expect, right? As Bob sends qubits, he's sort of transmitting the information.
And uniformly, no matter which ones he tosses away.
Yeah, but you could ask the further question, how useful is that correlation? And now we get into a kind of a more physical question. Does there exist a measurement that will reveal those correlations? And this is kind of preliminary, it's work with Debbie and some students. But what we've been finding is, at least for some scenarios that we've been studying, until Charlie has received the minimal number of qubits, right? So prior to his receipt of that minimal number of qubits, there is no measurement that Charlie and Alice could perform that would reveal any correlations. So the information is essentially locked away until the very last moment, and then it appears all at once. So there's this very, very striking rapid rise in the useful information coming out, as opposed to just the information measured by quantum mutual information. So this potentially has bearing on this black hole problem too, because it gives some indication as to why you would not expect to see correlations if you ever looked at correlation functions, because there are plausible reasons to think that the information is, we call it locked in quantum information theory, until the very last moment.
Let's thank you.